to CPRcommunitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. Begin with a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discuss Tuesday's midterm elections with Professor Tony Montero. We spoke with him live via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. Not really a blue wave for sure. I'm looking at the historical data, and it's less than typical for the midterms in the first year of a new president. And the Republicans increased their lead in the Senate. We're still waiting for a couple of races to be determined for sure, but they have an absolute majority. That's guaranteed.
Right, right. Yes, and I would say, Don, that what we're looking at, and this is a positive, is that politics writ large have broken out. We have, for many people, entered into a moment of political hell, where rather than strategic compromise and so-called consensus building, there's real political struggle afoot in the country. And interestingly enough, if you look at things outside of the brainwashing narrative of the corporate media, the thing that arose as a central factor in this election is class, the specter of class. And they talked about it by trying to obscure it by always saying that Trump's base are white men who don't have college degrees.
Right.
And who have lost everything or most everything in this rush to globalize the world economy. So we're looking at class. And I would say another thing is that what is appealing about Trump to what they call his base is that he is the anti-president president, the anti-elite president, the anti-elite media president. And that has a lot of appeal. In fact, I would even argue that for many people, including myself, it is aesthetically appealing. You know, a lot of people say, well, aesthetically, Trump is not presidential, or aesthetically, Trump looks like what we think a fascist should look like. But to me, there is something very appealing about what is breaking out in the country, including the press conference that Trump held yesterday, where he, you know, said that he and Pelosi could come to an agreement. And this is what was so interesting. He would rather have a Democratic majority in the House than to have a Republican majority where he only had a majority of two or three, because he felt that he could work with Pelosi and they could come to agreements on things such as climate change, the healthcare system, the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, and on and on and on. I think we've entered a very profound period of politics, too few of us fully recognize what is going on. It was not a defeat for Trump. It was a partial victory for the Democrats. The Democrats will not be able to unite in the House of Representatives. There are those who want to go for impeachment investigation, and there are people who are practical, like Nancy Pelosi and maybe Elijah Cummings and maybe some other of the older guard, who realize that if they overplay their hand, the chance of Trump being reelected are higher. But the most important thing is that while the Democrats won, the Democrats are probably the most disunited party that has power in the House of Representatives in our memory.
Yeah. You know, that press conference yesterday, there was something that caught my attention also, that little scuffle with Acosta from CNN.
Yeah.
And, you know, the attraction that you're talking about, seeing Trump mix it up with some of these people that represent the elite. I remember a press conference 2 years ago with Acosta in Havana, where he arrogantly started, you know, the same kind of questioning of Raul Castro over human rights. And he starts with, in broken Spanish, you know, my father was an exile from Cuba. Mm-hmm. Which tells me, looking at him, chances are his father worked for Batista.
Right, but, absolutely.
You know, okay. Mm-hmm. And then he starts running down, you know, Cuba, political prisoners, and all of this. So he asks the question of the two of them, and he also asks, he tags it with, you know, Mr. Castro, President Castro, do you favor Trump or Clinton, Hillary Clinton, in the election that was pending in 2016, and Castro said to that, I don't vote in the United States. That was his answer. But he served it up to Obama in a way that basically was giving Obama an opportunity to challenge his host on human rights. And the idea of an American president lecturing anyone in the Western Hemisphere on human rights is particular, from Havana, no less. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even think irony fits it. But this is the same guy. When I saw that press conference then, I was like, I wish I were in Havana right now so I could smack this guy in the back of his head. How dare he? Mm-hmm. And yet, yesterday, we watched Trump do it. For me, I was doing it vicariously through him over what he did in Havana. And yet Absolutely. They're painting this as fascism.
Well, I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't have a free press. The free press is the press on the margins, like what you do, like what Black Agenda does, what Truth Out, Truth Dig, Real News Network, and Global Research, places like that do.
Well, you can tell what's a free press on payday. On payday, our free press gets paid for free.
That's right. But it is not free from the interest of the deep state and the 1%. And guys like Acosta or Don Lemon or Anderson Cooper or Rachel Maddow, they are paid handsomely because they serve the most powerful economic, political interest in the country, and I would dare say those who represent this ruthless dictatorship over the masses of people in this country. And that is why Donald Trump's pushback and challenge to Acosta and his hangers-on was of such great significance. The corporate media has to be taken on at every opportunity, and thus new space is opened up for thought and really for class politics.
Right.
For class politics, and this is why how we understand the question of race and white supremacy is so very, very important. You know, you get all of these so-called liberal black and white politicians, most of whom are super rich, invoking race. But for them, race is but a trope for identity. They're talking about not the politics of racial liberation or black liberation.
Right.
They're talking about identity politics.
Right.
And far be it from any of them to even think about linking the question of race and black liberation to the liberation of the black working class and of the working class as a whole.
Right.
And so this blithe way that they throw around the question of white supremacy and homophobia and xenophobia, this is the language of the petty bourgeoisie,
right,
who can only imagine liberation as freedom for themselves. That's why they call it the Me Too movement and not the We Too movement.
That's right.
It's me first, me only, and me.
Right.
It's me.
It's atomic.
And that's the politics historically of the petty bourgeoisie,
right,
especially the petty bourgeoisie in a moment of crisis.
That's right. Yep. Atomized. I mean, and that's exactly how the bourgeoisie wants the rest of the society, is atomized.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well,
on the other side, you get this rising class development. It's not like people imagined it. It's not like maybe we would all want it. It doesn't have the aesthetics of a documentary of the Chinese Revolution or the Cuban Revolution.
Right.
But it's the way it's going to come. The logic is there. You got two sides, the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats are the party of the 1% and the deep state and the military. What we have in the Republican Party, which is the Trump Party increasingly, is the coming to the fore of interests that are more in alignment with that of working people. And that is what is being fought against by the Democrats. Now, the good thing is that the Democrats are a fractured, divided party that has nothing to hold it together, and they will fight each other more than they'll fight Trump within the next year.
You know, you've got a couple of things I want to parse out of that. I guess most immediately, some of the institutional characters in the Republican Party suddenly discovered over the last few weeks up through Tuesday that either they're with Trump or they're on the curb.
That's right.
Look at Ted Cruz, for example, who would have nothing to do with Trump before and who would be unemployed now, and, you know, back to ambulance chasing if it weren't for Trump coming to rally there. several other notables over the course of the campaign, and those that Trump turned his cold shoulder to are out, like Flake and et cetera. So there's that, this part of the calculus. But I want to go first to this, which is in terms of looking at how people refuse to look at the working class, politics that are involved heavily in all of this, definitely fail to look at the international working class. Right. Because if you're going to talk about white supremacy and an international working class, for example, then what do you call AFRICOM that was installed in Africa by America's quote-unquote first black president?
Absolutely.
That to me, the working class politics of it are, we surrendered a continent of the strongest, most forward-based part of the working class to the Pentagon.
Yeah. I mean, and what do you call the brutal war on Libya and the vicious assassination of its leader, Muammar Gaddafi?
Right.
Was that not a racist act? People say, well, he was an Arab. Well, don't Arabs, and have they not historically suffered from Western colonialism and racism?
Yeah.
Well, this is why I'm saying the struggle against racism as presented by the representatives of the Democratic Party and the so-called liberal academics is not really a struggle for freedom. It's a struggle for the individual to be free, not for humanity to be free, because they're very comfortable with U.S. imperialism, with the war on Africa, with the wars in the Middle East. They hardly raised any protest. And so we have to look not only at the subjective side of racism. In other words, as an individual, I experience racism because of the color of my skin. Okay, you do. But then let's look at the objective side as well. What is racism? What is the institutions and structures of racism? And how do we liberate the masses of people from the institutions of oppression? They will never be, the masses will never be integrated as into the system, as probably a Van Jones or a Barack Obama or a Andrew Gillum or whatever. They will never be integrated, and they're never intended to be integrated. So we're talking about a project of upward mobility into the ruling class of the black petty bourgeoisie, and not a program of the liberation of the masses. And this is where their talk of white supremacy and race becomes so distasteful and is done in such utter bad faith. And I include among those who have hoodwinked the masses of people by showing them a shiny object that's supposed to represent black liberation. I include among them, and at the top of the list, the Oprah Winfreys and the Barack Obamas, who are not a part of the great and historic struggle of black folk that is defined by what we call the black radical tradition. They are traitors to the masses of people, and they operate in the interest of the enemies, the class enemies of the vast majority of black working and poor people.
You know, one of the things that I found extremely ironic about Oprah Winfrey interjecting herself into the campaign in Georgia for Abrams was the absolute absence of Oprah Winfrey anywhere in the attack on Cynthia McKinney that was rolled out over several years.
Yeah.
When Cynthia McKinney was the only voice, for example, in the Congress and among the black leadership in the Congress and mostly throughout the country, standing up for people in New Orleans, for example. Probably the only person in Congress ever to put Rumsfeld on the stand and say, where's the missing $1 trillion? She gets run out of Congress over that, and Oprah Winfrey did not come to Georgia at that time or utter a word about it.
No. No. Nor will you find Oprah Winfrey raising her eloquence against police murders of young black men and women throughout the United States.
Right, or AFRICOM. Did she mention AFRICOM?
Oh, I haven't heard that either. No,
right, okay.
Nor did she oppose the wars in Iraq, Syria, right. Afghanistan, Libya.
Right.
So her talk of, you know, people fought so you would have the right to vote. Well, people fought so that we African Americans, at least on paper, would have equality. That was in the mid-20th century. Now, the struggle of the 21st century is that the substance of equality, which means economic, political, and social equality, right, are achieved. And that means structural changes, right, in the society.
Right. You have a society, actually, that has been developing in exactly the opposite direction for everyone, for the masses, mm-hmm, of people. And the only equality that has been under development is the equality of destitution.
Right. The equality of poverty. Yes.
Right.
Yes. And we see it. And in some of these polls, which are showing, and I think this is a profound development, that upwards of 40% of black people favor Trump's policies. A lot of people, especially on the two coasts, would ask, well, where are these black people? I've not met a black person that has expressed any inclination towards Trump. Well, they live in places like Detroit, in Cleveland, in Akron, in St. Louis, right, these heavily deindustrialized areas of the Midwest, you know? And I think there are black people who don't say it out loud.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of times whose voices are not given any weight, who say in privacy or even to a pollster, that I find his honesty refreshing. I find the fact that he is unscripted refreshing. I find the fact that he is seeking detente with Russia and North Korea, that something is going on here that could mean something positive for people like myself. That is what we're getting in the thinking of black people. They're not going to be on television. They're not going to be interviewed. In fact, the only time I've seen Richard Trumka interviewed on anything close to the corporate media was the other day on Fox. And he's the head of the AFL-CIO, and these trade deals are all about the historic opposition of the AFL-CIO towards NAFTA. But I don't hear his voice. I don't hear the voice of ordinary working people. I don't hear the voices of black folk, ordinary black folk, and their opinions of what is going on. But these so-called representatives that you see on CNN and MSNBC and sometimes on Fox and so on, this is what this is supposed to be the voice of the black masses. And I'm telling you, it's not. There are two different ideological developments here. In fact, I would dare say that something looking like a class and ideological conflict is developing within the ranks of black folk right now.
I would say also within the ranks of the working class in general in the United States.
I agree with you.
Because the other game that you have going on is symbolized by the political parties. But, you know, since the historical development of politics, of retail politics in the United States, leaves us with the situation of the Republican Party having been becoming the white man's party, the white people's party, as Glenn Ford calls it, the party of white supremacy, taking the place of the Democratic Party, which played that role from the beginning of the United States, more or less, since the founding of the Democratic Party, all the way up until, say, 1968, I guess, is probably where Nixon's Southern strategy first really took hold. I guess Goldwater was leaning that way and working it. But in 1964, you still had what happened in Atlantic City happen inside the Democratic Party. So I'd say from 1790, or 1789, 1790 until 1968, the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy, of Lester Maddox, of all of those guys, George Wallace, and on and on and on, and some much uglier ones, as a matter of fact, years before. So we come to the party dressed in the clothes that we have. You have the white working class having lifted Trump up inside the Republican Party, and you had had other parts of the working class, including parts of the white working class and millennials inside the Democratic Party, trying to lift Sanders up while the Clintonites were shooting at them. But that phenomenon comes out of the actual condition of the working class, and that shared condition militates towards class unity, but the retail politics is actually dragging it in another direction, and that's a problem to solve.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, you know, unless our lenses are sharpened through an understanding of class and how race and the black liberation struggle and the class conflict potentially overlap and intersect, unless we have a vision that also sees that black people, black workers, are the principal victims and the first victims of the neoliberal reorganization of the global economy, the first victims, and how now you see this rebellion among white working people, among white farmers, that might not yet see the black worker and the commonality there. But we who claim leadership, who claim to know, who claim science, have to say that if this logic continues, if it is not interrupted, if it is not repressed, that something new in the politics of this country is being born. And whether it comes through a Trump presidency or whether it comes through other forms of rebellion, so be it. But the question is, from a scientific standpoint, from a materialist point of view, what is going on and what is emerging? You know, Engels had this concept, the negation of a negation. You know what I'm saying? If the if the Republican Party became the white man's party after Nixon, let us say, then, and it was a negation of the previous Republican kind of stand of Eisenhower and what came before that, going back to Lincoln. If the Southern strategy was a negation of that, then is this not a negation of the Southern strategy, of the white man's party strategy? And this is what I think is emerging.
Yeah, I mean, we saw firsthand at the RNC, contrary to our expectations of people wanting to, you know, they were fighting over abortion and gay marriage and all of that, looking at Trump, and we saw this during the campaign leading up to the RNC, and saying, yeah, maybe I voted over that stuff before. I don't care about abortion. I don't care about gay marriage. I don't care about any of this other stuff. That guy's going to get me a job. That's what I care about. And there was a sense there, those people understood what was happening with the people lifting up Sanders. They were a lot more willing to take a look across the aisle at the people that were lifting up Sanders and seeing a commonality of interest being expressed there than the people at the DNC were to look back at the RNC and say, you know, now, there are historical reasons for this that I understand. If I'm getting my butt kicked my whole life for my skin color, for example, and a guy in exactly my condition is, you know, getting driven around in a limo over his skin color, when he comes to talk to me, say, let's forget this skin color thing, I'm going to be looking at him a little funny. But when I see that neither of us are going to go anywhere unless we work that problem out, that's another matter.
Well, and that's what's going on. And I would say, I think I mentioned this to you before in one of our interviews, that in a lot of ways, this election was about the two sides in a profound and historic ideological conflict. The question of the elites versus the masses. Now, of course, in 2 years, I don't know what Trump has delivered materially to the working class, or they claim something from tax cuts. But I think the big question was a referendum on a rebellion against the ruling elites. That's what 2018 was about.
Right.
And it was, in all indications, it was a standoff.
Right.
We're pretty much where we were after the election of 2016.
Right.
Nothing fundamentally changed.
Which is pretty amazing given the media campaign that's taken place uninterrupted for 2 years.
No question.
You know, I remember in 2004 when it looked like Howard Dean was going to be a shoo-in. He's on TV. Mm-hmm. He screams for 3 seconds. The media tanked him for 2 days and he was off the scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they've done in terms of the coverage with Trump since the middle of 2015, really, but certainly since the spring of 2016, and he hasn't gone down in the polls at all, really. He hasn't been injured by it at all.
He understands what Howard Dean did not understand. He understands the media.
Right.
He understands the players, the structure, how they function. And so... And he also understands that the media, which is driven by profit, cannot sustain anything for so long. So any story only has a short shelf life, maybe of a few hours, and then it moves on to something else. So he understands that. He understands how to play the media, and he's not intimidated by the media. And that's a great advantage in this struggle.
I think that we're going to have to take a look at what develops in the media next, the next media narrative next week. We appreciate your time, Tony. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Both the Republicans and Democrats claim victory in the wake of the midterm elections. But it seems the election settled little, if anything. Now there is dueling investigation warfare, gridlock on steroids. Is this what the voters voted for? Crosstalking after the midterms, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Flanagan in Washington. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. In New York, we have Rochelle Ritchie. She is a political analyst and a former press secretary for House Democrats. And in St. Paul, we cross to David Schultz. He is a Hamline University professor of political science. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Rochelle, let me go to you first in New York. We know what the results of the elections are. But what are the lessons to be drawn from it? I mean, we both have we see the Republicans and Democrats claiming victory, and they have their points, but we still have the same kind of polarization. And as I said in my introduction, it looks like we're going to have dueling investigations. Is this what the voters voted for? Go ahead, Rochelle in New York.
Well, you know, I had a lot of hope after the election that maybe the tide had turned and maybe that the divisiveness that we saw in our country would start to diminish. But as you have seen, that does not seem to be the case. We have the president coming out and already calling some things fake news. We have, you know, reporters fighting with the president. So it just seems like this is going to continue. But what I am proud of as far as what happened with the election is the diversity that we saw as a result of people heading to the polls. You had the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. You had two African-American women in Connecticut and Massachusetts that are the first African-Americans women to represent their district. So this was a very exciting time as far as diversity in our country. But it seems like we're right back to the warfare that you just mentioned when it comes to politics in our country. And I don't think this is what the American people want. I think the American people want our politicians to get to work and get things under control. But now it seems that it's going to continue to be this sort of political divide. And now it's going to be on Capitol Hill even more, obviously, with the Democrats controlling the House and the Republicans controlling the Senate.
Okay, Michael, I mean, again, Rochelle talked about diversity, and that's really what the Democrats talk about all the time. But what about unity? I think that's what we're really missing here. How do we unify? And there's no one really talking about that. We did have some kind of overture from President Trump. We'll see where that goes. But we haven't surmounted the divisions here. I mean, the first thing, you know, we're going to impeach Kavanaugh. We're going to investigate Trump's tax returns. Did the electorate vote for those things? Go ahead, Michael.
It's a great question, and I'm not sure what the electorate voted for. The vast majority of Americans want their government to get along, and this creeping understanding, quote-unquote understanding of conventional wisdom that Americans love divided government. Americans do not love divided government. That's a myth. Wall Street loves divided government because it gives stasis to particularly financial transactions and gives the Fed a lot of power. So Wall Street loves divided government. Businesses often like divided government. But people do not like the fighting that Rochelle was talking about. They just don't. Americans are generally nice people that like people to get along. And I look forward to Nancy reaching out to not the president so much, although that's her inclination, reach out to the Republicans in the House. There is so much work that the House needs to do with itself, and Rochelle, having had her time at the House, knows how the chamber functions and how dysfunctional it's become in the last 20 years. It just doesn't work like it ought to work. And Nancy made some really interesting remarks, which kind of went under the radar after the election, talking about restoring transparency to the House and trying to do other things. But she was talking about house cleaning in the House of Representatives. And if they can restore power to committee chairmen, if they can do the work that needs to be done, throttle the Appropriations Committee, get back to a budget cycle, work with Republicans, bring back the earmark. I know that's heresy, but I'm a big fan of that because it allows Congress to do what its main function is to tax me and spend my money instead of shipping it off to the administration and having them spend it for me. I mean, these are things that if the House goes back to doing these things, they must get along to do them. And then that getting along will get the appropriations process, will get the authorization process, the kind of oversight Nancy's looking to do will bring all that back, hasn't happened in a long time.
I can tell that you were in Congress because you make a lot of sense here, but unfortunately, politics interrupts. David, one of the outcomes of the election I think is fair is that now the GOP is the party of Trump. The never-Trumpers are essentially gone. Now, Michael was suggesting that Nancy Pelosi talk to the Republicans. Well, this is the Trump Republican Party right now. And when you have so many divisive figures in the Democratic Party, any kind of compromise is considered appeasement. And that's what bothers me. That's what bothers me about these investigations, where Russiagate is going to go. Is the investigations into the DOJ and the FBI going to be shut down completely because they don't suit the narrative of the Democrats? David, we politics interrupts always. Go ahead in St. Paul.
Okay, a couple of things first. I was never so optimistic that I thought this election was going to really bring the United States together. Let's say that even if the Democrats had taken both the House and the Senate, we still would have had divided government. We would have had the Democrats on one side, the Trump Republican Party on the other side in the executive branch. So I was never optimistic. But what we did see in this election, getting to your question here, is that as a result now, we have a House of Representatives that's Democratic and obviously far more liberal than it was before, a Republican Senate that is more Republican and more conservative than it was before. They're moving in opposite directions at this point, and finding common ground is going to be even more difficult than it was before. So that's one observation. The second observation is there probably were some people who voted and said, yes, we want Trump impeached, we want Trump investigated, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a certain amount of what Congress is legitimately supposed to do is oversight. There's a certain concept called checks and balances. But now the question is, how do the Democrats respond in terms of moving forward, as well as the Republicans? We'll do two choices here. Choice one, in the next few days, do the Democrats go with Nancy Pelosi as the speaker, or do they go with somebody else? That sends a signal in terms of who's in charge of the Democratic Party. Two, do they go for what, the full throttle impeachment investigations, or do they do what I would recommend that they do, is to say, pass all of their legislation, pass everything they want, send it to the Senate, force the Republicans to have to react to it, force Trump to have to react to it, and then either hope it gets signed or run against them like crazy in 2020. These, I think, are going to tell us something about the control of the Democratic Party, equally as we know that the Republican Party is now firmly within the grasp of Donald Trump.
Okay, we're going to have you back often. I love that kind of analysis. Rochelle in New York, respond to what David had to say with the different options. Brilliant analysis. Go ahead.
Well, look, the first thing is impeachment is not really a popular idea, whether you're asking Democrats, independents, and obviously Republicans. So, and I think that we have to be careful when we start talking about impeachment, because even though the Democrats have control of the House, they would still have to have two-thirds of the vote in the Senate. And I don't think that the Senate is going to obviously vote to impeach the president until the Mueller investigation is done. And unless that investigation reveals some sort of criminal behavior on behalf of the president, I don't see impeachment actually working or really getting the support of American voters, because it's already not a popular idea. And we have to also remember that, yes, people did head to the polls and vote against Donald Trump. I think there was a poll out that said 39% of people were voting to oppose Trump. So a lot of people weren't even voting in response to the ideas. But, you know, as far as Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House, I do think that, you know, people want change. This is a very, like David said, a more liberal Democratic House that we've seen before. But, you know, I was the press secretary for the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, and we had three co-chairs, and that was David Cicilline, Sherry Bustos, and Hakeem Jeffries. And the one that I, out of those three, that is really popular on both sides of the aisle is Hakeem Jeffries. And, you know, I think that if the Democrats voted Hakeem Jeffries as Speaker, obviously if he decided that's what he wanted, I think he would be a really good candidate for that, considering he would also be the first Black Speaker of the House, which would be very historic, and also pull in those African-American voters that are kind of split right now between, you know, being a Democrat or being an independent.
Okay, Michael, one of the things that I found interesting is that Trump made it all about himself, and the liberal media was more than willing to give him that there. So he still calls the shots here. Also, I think in the wake of this election, the GOP is unified and unified around the president. I think the Democrats show there's a lot of splits in going further to the left. We have the old guard, Pelosi, that wants to hang around. I mean, it's really the Democrats that have to really clean up their house and get unified, because during the election, they were all repeated the same talking points. I mean, I find it amazing. OK, the problem is how the Democrats will be able to move forward. Go ahead, Michael, before we go to the break.
Yeah, and you steal my talking points, Peter. It's so enervating. I have these little things I want to say, and then you say them for me. The biggest problem that the new Democratic Speaker is going to face is getting something out of her caucus. She has she will have one of the smallest margins in history, which means she'll have to get virtually a unanimous vote every time she does anything. I am going on record right now predicting that she will lose some journal votes, and Rochelle might know what I mean by that. Some ordinary, regular, run-of-the-mill votes will go down as certain members of her caucus peel off to try and make a point or show her a lesson. She's not going to be able to pass anything out of the House with any regularity or certainty. It's kind of like watching the Republicans in the Senate in the last Congress. You know, will they get enough votes together or won't they? You're going to be seeing that daily in the House. And it'll be up to the Republicans to help her. And I think in a lot of things, the Republicans will be glad to help her if we can approach this in a conciliatory fashion. And that's going to involve a lot of the things that, your other two guests have talked about today, and whether they're going to proceed in a thoughtful, let's run the government way, or
hold
in a political, let's have
thought.
Total
there,
power way.
Hold that thought. We're going to go to a hard break. After that short break, we'll continue our discussion on After the Midterms.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to David in St. Paul. Immediately after the election results came in, President Donald Trump fired his attorney general, or told him to resign, Jeff Sessions. What does that tell you? Is that some kind of veiled threat? Because he's going to have a temporary AG there that will probably act very differently than Jeff Sessions, because he doesn't have to worry about being tied to any kind of commitment vis-a-vis Russiagate. What was Trump telling everybody?
Well, I think there's a couple things he's telling, and he's also a couple things that he learned from the election. Now, think about it right now. There's no, under the current lineup here, there's no serious chance with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate that they're going to do any serious investigations of Donald Trump, or would probably act at all upon any conclusions that, the Mueller investigation comes with. Come January, though, kind of a wild card here in terms of what the Democrats may or may not do. And I think by removing Jeff Sessions at this point and sort of holding the Mueller investigation hostage a little bit here, Trump gives himself some leverage in terms of perhaps shutting down the investigation as a message to the Democrats to say that if you move on anything, I'm just not going to cooperate. Or perhaps in the situation here, anticipating that the Democrats may do something, I'm just going to get rid of Bob Mueller at this point, and therefore I'm going to have a fight directly with you. And if I fight directly with you, what does that do? That plays incredibly well with my base in 2020 if I'm running for re-election. So I would view this as a threat, a little bit of a strategic remover, kind of like a chess match in terms of saying that if you are going to now investigate or do more against me, I am going to respond in ways to try to protect myself. So it's an interesting set of maneuvers going on here.
Okay, on the same theme, Rochelle, let me quote Donald Trump in his tweet here. If the Democrats think they are going to waste taxpayer money investigating us at the House level, then we will likewise be forced to consider investigating them for all the leaks of classified information and much else at the Senate level. Two can play the game. What are your thoughts, Rochelle?
You know, this tit-for-tat, you know, mentality that we're seeing on Capitol Hill is really embarrassing. I mean, this investigation started under a Republican-controlled House and Senate. And so, look, I think that the president basically picked Matthew Whitaker because Matthew Whitaker had already came out and said that the Russian probe was going too far and that Rod Rosenstein needed to put some sort of limitations on this investigation that Mueller was conducting. So we know why this is happening. It's happening because the president doesn't want the truth to come out. And that's the bottom line. And as I said before, you know, if the truth does come out and the president was involved in some sort of criminal behavior, the only way that he's really going to end up being impeached is if the Senate approves of that. And so I think that it would kind of backfire on Republicans if it is found that the president was involved in some sort of criminal activity. And they said, well, forget it. We'll forgive him anyway, and we're not going to impeach him as a result of that. I think that would backfire, maybe not so much for Trump supporters, but for those loyal conservatives that are really committed to conservative principles, I think that it would backfire on Republicans for those people.
Michael, weigh in on that, because, you know, the Russiagate isn't predicated on a crime. Unlike Watergate, for example, there is no crime. They're investigating if there could be a crime. Everything is turned upside down. I think that what Trump is saying is that if you want to continue this, then I think it's fair game. What about all of that leaking and unmasking, all of that stuff, which has not been touched, at least as far as we know in the public here? I mean, there's a lot to find out, which the liberal CNN and MSNBC almost completely ignore. But there's a lot out there. Go ahead, Michael.
Well,
Yeah, let me unpack just a little bit what something your other two guests, I think, glossed over. I think they might be coming from a premise that there's something, even if it's not illegal, to investigate. I'm going to come from the premise that Trump's done nothing wrong and that Mueller's investigation is largely political and always has been. What he's managed to find are all sorts of ancillary things about people around him. Manafort and others and things that they've done previously in their life and a bunch of Russians who will never show up in court or the ones that do will show up by proxy. But it's not developed into anything that affects the president directly. And I think he's coming from a place where he knows it never will because there's nothing there. So I think what you always hope that Sessions would do and didn't, and what Rosenstein would do and didn't, and what his new acting AG will do is that limit Manafort and say, focus on me, focus on whatever you think I've done or whatever you think my administration has done or my campaign, as the case may be. Focus on that. Let's have a report. Let's get it over with and let's get it done and leave all the ancillary matters out, including what my taxes look like and all the other things the Democrats would love to drag forward for fun and profit. This is, I think, the reason that Sessions is gone, is because he couldn't put his arm around the investigation, not so much to hide for Trump, but to focus and say, let's do this and get it over with.
You know, David, it also, I think, very simply is that Trump would like to have his own AG. I mean, I don't think every other president has had that privilege. I think Trump would like to have the same. Go ahead. You wanted to jump in St. Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, a couple things here. First, I was going to say is that, you know, when people say, well, did Trump do something wrong? Did you do something wrong in terms of the premises here? I mean, part of why we have criminal investigations is to do what? Is to actually find some of this stuff out. And so I'm hesitant to sort of leap to any conclusions one way or the other in terms of did he do something wrong or not do anything wrong. Also keep in mind that not all special prosecutors or not all prosecutors wind up going into something to investigate and wind up indicting on that. They find other stuff that's out there. So this whole argument of sort of saying it's fishing trip or prosecutors are on fishing trips or it's sort of political, you know, I kind of cast that off to the side and say that's a sort of partisan language being used on both sides.
I'm sorry. I don't usually interrupt, but that's not partisan language. If you're there to find out official wrongdoing in the sake of government and you wind up fishing and you wind up finding money laundering in the Ukraine from 15 years before, that's fine and that's good and I love to have crimes found and taken care of. But it's not part of the job of the special prosecutor to be doing that. If your life or my life were attacked in the same way, we couldn't survive it. We just couldn't. So, I mean, what I'm saying is if you want to focus on the Russia investigation, please do. And everything associated with that, and that's all well and fine. And if you find somebody that you didn't go after originally involved in this, my goodness, yes, burn them down. But if you're just grabbing people that might be associated with the president and set them on fire for something they've done years ago, that's the stuff that you should make the referral to the AG, make the referral to the state prosecutors or whomever, and move on. This is not what he was commissioned to do. And it's okay that he's done it. It's fine. It's great. But if that's why it's being kept alive, it should be stopped.
Okay, David, finish your point, and then I'll go to Rochelle. Go ahead. Finish your point, David.
I'm sorry, David.
That's the point of the program. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. First, I was going to say is that he has referred things to other prosecutors, such as in New York, you know, tying into people like Cohen and so forth like that. So to say that he hasn't been doing that, I'd say that's inaccurate. The second thing is, you know, that let's say somebody's investigating one crime as a prosecutor and they uncover others. And for you to say, well, heck, because you were investigating one thing and not another, you should ignore the other ones. That's really not a good argument. What I'm getting at here is that, yes, he was put together to look at what was happening with Russia, finding other things that are going on out there. And again, I have no idea what's going to be found at this point. When people say, what's Mueller going to conclude? He could very well conclude when this investigation is over, the president did nothing wrong, nobody else did anything wrong. He can conclude a whole bunch of other different things.
All right, David, let me jump in because I want to talk about other things here. Because my whole attitude about this whole hoax is that if there was something out there, it would have been leaked a long, long time ago. Anyway, let's move on. Rochelle, I want to go to a different topic here. If the Democrats take a very hard line position vis-a-vis Donald Trump, do the Democrats fear that they could create a red undertow since in 2020, since there was no blue wave in 2018?
Well, look, I think that there was a little bit of a blue wave. The Democrats did pick up more seats than what they had expected in the House.
Historical lows.
And, you know, the historical, Republicans were saying,
historical lows for midterms. But go ahead. Keep going.
Well, I think that you also have to consider that 77% of this country is divided. 55% or so do not approve of this president, and 39% of voters voted against him. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2020. And let's keep in mind that it really seems that what we saw in the midterm elections is that the Democrats really did win the popular vote, if you will. I mean, they picked up seven gubernatorial governor elections. They won those, which they really weren't expecting to win, and we're still on hold to see what's going to happen in Georgia as well. But I think this is a good indication for Democrats that people are sort of fed up with what they're seeing happen with this president. And look, it's not just about his policies. Yes, the economy is doing great. That's wonderful. But when it comes to health care and when it comes to some of the racist rhetoric that we see coming from this administration, people do not like that. And it's funny because it's like we had this whole fear-mongering thing happening with this immigration caravan or these illegal immigrants that were trying to come into our country, and now we're not even hearing about it. So I think that the president will find another fear-mongering tactic to get his base out to vote
okay,
for
let
him.
Me,
and I think that the
we're
Democrats
almost out, Michelle, we're almost out of time.
Are waking up to
we're
that.
Almost out of time. I want to give Michael the last word here. I really hate how MSNBC and CNN race bait all the time through these campaigns. I think it's going to continue. Michael, my final question, 40 seconds. Is it a good idea for the Democrats to continue to work against Trump in the way they do in the media? Because it doesn't seem he's like a weeble. He wobbles, but he doesn't fall down. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, as I observed a year ago, a little bit longer on your show, I think it was here on your show, Trump is like a black hole, and I meant that in a good way. You know, the more garbage that's thrown at him, the bigger and stronger he gets. He thrives on conflict. If I were a Democrat, I would avoid giving this to him. And I don't think of Democrats and the media in the same breath. I think the media are there to sell soap, and they'll do whatever they have to do it. I think the Democrats have an opportunity to separate themselves out and be able to do what needs to be done, and that's manage the business of government from the people's house. And I hope that they will do that. And I think if they do, they'll find Republicans to help them.
Very, very well said to end the program. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in St. Paul. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.